first part. I think I bit my tongue.
Oh, that's
yeah, no one cares about your tongue. Hello and welcome to another episode of WonkCast. We are the independent student podcast for brief policy perspectives of the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. This is a policy roundtable where we dive deep into a range of policy issues and generally discuss all things wonky. Before we dive in, a bit of housekeeping. Please rate and review this show on iTunes. It takes a few seconds and it makes a huge difference. For this episode, I, regular contributor Haley Dunn, we'll be filling in for our usual moderator, Nathan Rupp, who is out of town. Let's see who else we have here with us today.
I'm Adam Brooks. I'm interested in national security and program analysis.
I'm Elizabeth Moorhead, and I'm interested in social policy.
Hi, I'm Mira Herrera, and I am interested in education policy, and I am today's special guest, and we'll be talking about teacher diversity.
First off is a segment we call Below the Fold. Each of us has prepared a quick take on a policy issue that is in the news but may have been overlooked due to the bold headlines, of which we have had quite a few in the past week and a half. We will be posting links to the articles that contributors read for this segment on our Facebook page and on the Brief Policy Perspectives website if you would like to get more information. Who would like to go first?
I'll go. Okay, so my topic is dealing with JP Morgan Chase and some of the work that they've been doing in the Detroit community. So as of late, JP Morgan Chase has invested $12.5 million into Detroit to help boost the city's workforce readiness. So the jobs that they have been seeking to fill are for those that have a high school diploma, but below a college degree. So that is the class that they're looking to help. And it first started with trying to understand Detroit's current workforce system. And they did a launch of a leadership academy that was a 12-month intensive where it was kind of like a sharing of learning between some of the head people in the Detroit workforce already to help understand what was going on. And from that, they have been able to invest in organizations that already exist. And then a third thing they did was use big data to kind of analyze the workforce that existed. And they found that there were a lot of small businesses that were getting a lot of people were supporting. So they have a actually very successful small business industry there. About 58% of consumers spending took place in small businesses. So they think that's also a promising area to fuel money into to help the economy grow.
Awesome. Thanks, Liz. Who wants to go next?
I'll go next.
Okay.
All right. So I'm going to talk about the Section 809 panel interim report, which just came out on May 17th. Some background on this. It's about defense acquisition reform, so super interesting.
Riveting.
So it was actually, it gets its name from Section 809 of the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2016. This was created to come up with a set of recommendations to streamline the defense acquisition process and make it more efficient. Acquisitions make up roughly $300 billion of DOD's budget, so about half of DOD's budget goes toward acquisition. In a nutshell, the report recommends simplifying the acquisition process and replacing the risk-averse, compliance-based culture at DOD with a results-oriented culture of accountability. The panel claims that this would allow DOD to allocate its resources more effectively and to better leverage the defense marketplace. Basically, what that's saying is because the process is so complex and complicated, a lot of companies choose not to deal with DOD at all because meeting compliance standards is just too complicated, too expensive. And so they want to shift the focus away from how do we get these things to what do we get. Now, the main question here is anything going to come of this? And it's a maybe. It's like a big maybe. So let's hope something actually comes out of this and we have a more efficient defense acquisition program.
All right, so I'll go next because I decided to muscle into Adam's territory this week, and I also have a story about the Department of Defense and accountability.
Amateurs over here. Amateur hour now.
Well, I'll give it my best shot. So, right now we are gearing up for the first ever audit of the Department of Defense. The DoD is the world's largest employer and has an incredibly massive and expensive bureaucracy. So this audit is legally mandated, but has been delayed to some embarrassment within the government. So basic questions like exactly how many employees and contractors the DoD has are as yet unanswered, even as we discuss budget allocations. So there are some partial reports of misappropriations of anywhere from hundreds of billions to several trillions of dollars. So it would be very interesting to get an audit for this. This is something that the Trump administration has been pushing for, which is great. And many politicians have recently been calling for an audit, everyone from Hillary Clinton to the House Freedom Caucus. So it has pretty bipartisan support. And Trump's nominee for comptroller of the Pentagon, David Norquist, has committed to having the audit completed by March 2019 with some interim reports in the meantime.
Wait, so, Norquist, the anti-tax pledge guy?
No. It's his brother.
Oh, of course it is.
Yes, it's actually the brother of the anti-tax Norquist. So, not the same one.
Did they do that on
But
purpose?
Related. I have no idea. Okay. So anyway, this is going to be a massive undertaking, which is the main reason it hasn't been done before. So there are estimates that an audit would have to account for between 15 to 20 million contracting transactions every year, in addition to everything else that the Pentagon and the Department of Defense overall does. So we've also been at war for years, so dedicating resources to an audit has not been a high priority. So that is something that will be really interesting to see. I think it's an important thing to have in terms of knowing how the money that we allocate is being used. I don't think it necessarily translates to allocating less money, but...
I think it's impossible. I mean, you look at DoD's budget, it's literally bigger than... It's bigger than any corporation, like any of the biggest
corporations. It is the largest employer in the world, which yes. I didn't know. And it is going to be a complicated issue. It's going to be interesting. I think even if it's a partial report... There are things that we should be, like, they should be able to tell us how many people work for them. That's a question that should be able to be answered. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Okay, I guess it's my turn to go. So I am going to be talking about some proposals that came out this week from the Trump administration in regard to student loans. This program has actually caused some bit of a problem. It's cost more than was originally anticipated. This would have some problematic implications as it would deter some students or recent graduates from going into federal government, state, or local government, as this is one way or one incentive to get them there to combat whatever low pay that they might have. It also includes some nonprofits, so there might be some implications with recent graduates going to those employers as well. The other change would be a change to income-based repayment. There's currently five income-based repayment plans, and this would change to one income-based repayment plan. It would cap at 12.5% of the borrower's income. It's currently capped at 10% of income now. And after 15 years with the new plan, then the balance would be forgiven. Currently, it is 20 years for undergraduate, and those are for both for undergraduates. Where it's actually going to make some substantial changes would be for graduate students, where the current cap right now is 25 years. So not only would that percentage increase, but it would also change the number of years to 30 years for graduate students in order to get any type of forgiveness.
Yeah, and that applies to all of us.
Yeah, right? It does.
And it seems like it would also, you know, really screw over people who had already committed to doing a life of public service. They may have turned down a job where they would have been offered a higher salary to expecting a loan for it.
There's no grandfather period.
I'm not sure if those people would be grandfathered in or not, actually. It'd be interesting. It is just a proposal, so it'll be interesting to see what
if they do the grandfather.
Yeah, what
actually comes out of it. Because it seems like that would be... It seems outrageous if they would not grandfather in people who've already committed years to this.
And who've already been approved.
Yeah.
There are people that are on that trajectory, and that's what their plan was to do anyway. And they've stayed with some sort of governmental agency or nonprofit for so many years and just haven't submitted an application yet either. So those people might not qualify.
Wow. Well, it's something we'll all be paying attention to then.
Mm-hmm. That sucks.
Yeah. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. I'm glad we have you around, Adam.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for your delightful news tidbits. We will be right back with our main segment on teacher diversity. Discussing the importance of teacher diversity and related policy issues. Miral, would you like to start us off with some background info on this topic?
Yeah, definitely. So currently, over 50% of all K-12 students in the United States are students of color. In states like California, or specifically in Texas, over 71% or 70% of students are students of color or mixed race students. Now, the diversity when it comes to teachers doesn't necessarily match up to that, with the majority of teachers still being white females. This can have implications for students and teachers. In terms of students, there's been a lot of documented research that students of color benefit from having teachers of color in the classroom. They have higher expectations for students of color. They're able to make cultural connections and establish relationships that can help enhance student learning within the classroom. One of the most difficult things in actually retaining and recruiting students of color or teachers of color has been the actual gap in student attainment for students of color. So if you don't have black and brown people graduating from high school, let alone graduating from college, your pool is smaller than to choose from to recruit for teaching positions. A lot of times those people who are eligible or do go through college and complete college, they don't end up going into the teaching profession. And there's a few reasons for that. One being the actual perception of teaching and the need to have a higher income job. A lot of times students of color will have larger amounts of student debt that they need to pay out. They will have families that they need to support. So going into teaching doesn't seem feasible for a lot of those individuals. So there are definitely programs and there's definitely efforts that are being made to increase teacher diversity. One of the biggest problems,
No, it's fine. Before we get more into policy, would you mind elaborating a little bit on what kind of, why is it important to both white students and to students of color to have teachers that reflect the diversity that's in the student body?
Yeah, so a lot of times students of color can go through their entire education experience with never seeing a teacher that looks like them. So what this does, it provides real life role models for them to look up to. It can also break down barriers that white students might have and attitudes towards people of color. And additionally, for students of color, it can serve as some sort of aspiration for those students to then look up to. So how can you envision yourself as a teacher if you've never seen a teacher that looks like you? Mm-hmm. Or how do you think that people from your community can go to college and then work if you've never seen that before? So it has positive impacts there, aside from the other impacts that I talked about, where teachers of color have set higher expectations for students of color, where a lot of times, there's been a ton of studies to show this, that white teachers will actually set lower expectations for students of color.
Okay, great, thank you. So you had mentioned one of, you know, the reasons that we have this problem now, with we have a lack of teacher diversity in K-12 education, is the kind of school attainment gap of the teachers when they were students. What are some other things that you think could be obstacles for people of color who might otherwise want to go into teaching who either aren't able to or aren't as interested? Could you elaborate a little bit more?
Yeah, I think the perception of the teaching profession in general, and you see this, you know, for everybody, there is a negative, almost a negative perception of teaching, that you're not going to make money, that there is not going to be room for an advancement. And for motivated, ambitious young people of color, that might not be something that's attractive to them.
Right.
And if from a young age you're socialized to see that as a profession for white women, then it's really hard to see yourself in those roles.
Do you think that another obstacle could be the experiences of teachers of color in their schools, either with school management or their experiences already being teachers? Like, is there also a problem of retention?
I have a comment on this. I went to a conference today and they were talking about ever since Brown versus Board of Education, black teachers weren't allowed to teach white students after that. And a lot of the black schools were shut down and it just never really recovered from that moment. So just historically, black teachers have been kind of lessened since Brown versus Board, which is kind of an unintended consequence of it. A negative consequence.
So you're saying the black teachers who had taught at the segregated schools weren't then currently getting jobs at the integrated schools.
Right. So after integration, it didn't really transpire into there being black teachers.
So we already talked about sort of student loan repayment programs. I know there's a payment repayment program for teachers. Has that helped get more, diversity among teachers, or has that not had any impact, or?
I mean, you still see, and I can't speak specifically to this. I haven't seen research on it, but it is for all teachers in general. So keeping that in mind, it's not targeted at teachers of color.
Right, but I know you said that teachers of color, for example, tend to have higher amounts of debt. So it would benefit them more, wouldn't it?
I would assume so. I haven't seen any studies that have identified any correlation between the two. I can't really speak to that.
So before I cut you off, you were starting to go into what kind of policies have been proposed to deal with this.
There are great things that people are trying to do to actually increase the number of teachers of color. One program that I think is really great and has a lot of potential, and there are programs like this all over the country, but are Grow Your Own programs. So what those programs actually do is they recruit people from the community or start recruiting students in high school. So there's actually teaching magnet programs or teaching programs in some high schools. One particular program in Pittsburgh, they actually allow high school students to then go into elementary classrooms and start learning pedagogy and start interacting with students, so they have more of an idea of what they're actually going to expect when going into the classroom. There's other programs that allow pathways for staff to then go into the teaching profession and providing more incentives for teachers to go into teacher prep program, or for students to go into teacher prep programs has been one of them. A lot of districts have started to partner with teacher prep programs at their local universities to funnel students from their communities into those colleges, who will then end up doing their student teaching internships within that same school district. So those are a few of the programs. Also, the Grow Your Own, like I mentioned, in allowing for pathways for staff or paraprofessionals within schools to then become teachers. Those individuals may have lower turnover rates because they've already been working in those schools. They know what to expect. They know the students. They know the community. And a lot of times that expectation can really help retain teachers. A lot of times teachers will go into the classroom and it will be not what they expected, or the management or administration at the school will be something that they didn't expect. So having a realistic expectation going into it can help actually retain them.
I think that Grow Your Own program is really interesting. As somebody that comes from a poorer city, I come from Syracuse, and in Syracuse there are no jobs, and so a lot of the young people there that do end up getting an education move away because there's no jobs.
Like you.
Right, exactly. And I've always thought that one great way to keep people in the community, or to get people back into the community, was to provide incentives for people to stay or come back to their community. We kind of do this in New York State. The governor and the legislature just passed a law that makes tuition free for state universities on the condition that you live and work in New York State. So that's something that I think we should be promoting more in general, is that grow your own mentality. Is you educate your own, and then you encourage them to stay in the community and help the community.
That's interesting. It's also teacher retainment and recruiting teachers to rural districts is also pretty difficult. So in Colorado, I believe they have a severe teacher shortage, I think about 3,000, and it's really difficult for them to recruit people to work in some of the rural districts. And so this impacts students of color, but this retainment issue with teachers is across the board. There's teacher deficits and shortages in a lot of states, and it's not just for districts or schools that are predominantly low income or predominantly Black and brown.
Well, I think some of these things could remove barriers for people entering the teaching profession. Mm-hmm. Like, I was reading something about, and I think this is kind of what you were talking about, like alternative route programs. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting what you brought up about, like, I know my home state of Massachusetts, like, you have to get a master's degree in your field or you cannot be a teacher. Right. And so you have a certain amount of time if you're already a teacher to do that. But having those kind of strict requirements could potentially have a discriminatory impact.
Yeah, I was going to actually do Teach for America, and I got placed in Illinois. Mm-hmm. But Illinois is one of the schools that requires you to get your master's to be a teacher. But Teach for America doesn't pay for the master's. So I would have been having to be doing Teach for America and paying for my master's in education. And specifically, I was placed to do special education. So my master's would have had to be in special education, which discouraged me from doing the program. Not to bash Teach for America, because I wanted to do it, so I think it's great. But it just was like I didn't want to get my master's in education or special education. So it would have been like me coming out of pocket to do something I didn't want to do.
Right, and that's a huge obstacle.
Yeah, right. There are some states that allow for pathways to teaching for in-field teachers, mm-hmm. so teachers coming from different industries, and at times I believe they need to take certain exams, and then that then allows them to go into teaching and offers an alternate route for those people wanting to go into the field who went and got a degree and know or experts in some field and want to go into the classroom.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of an impossible question to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay, here we go.
Well, to what degree do you think discrimination against the teachers themselves could be impacting participation in the teaching field by people of color?
So I think in terms of retention, and teachers of color have lower retention rates than white teachers, this makes it definitely has an impact on those individuals that are in the classroom. And a lot of times, teachers of color are more likely to be in urban schools, schools that have larger Black and Latino populations, schools that have lack of resources, schools that are Title I or have lower income students. And those are just sometimes harder students to teach, and you need additional resources and you need additional support. And when that's lacking, that can then impact a teacher's view and perception of their current job, where they think that they are undervalued. A lot of times, Black and brown teachers will then become a disciplinarian, and they will be put with certain sets of students because they work well with those students, but a lot of times then that hinders whatever aspirations that they have. I have a particular friend, she actually is an English teacher, and this is just anecdotal evidence. I don't know it's not actual, like, published or anything.
It's her favorite kind of evidence.
But
we thrive on anecdotal evidence.
She's an English teacher, and she is in a predominantly Latino school, and she would prefer to be teaching students about literature and in a more advanced setting, but she was then placed into an ESL classroom because she was one of the few teachers at her school that speaks Spanish. So those are the types of situations that happen. So then you look at the segregation that's within schools. So even a diverse school, there will be segregation within that. So in your advanced placement classes, where that might be where most of the white students are, those teachers of color aren't having an opportunity to go teach those classrooms to then break down those barriers and those perceptions that those students have of Black and brown people.
One thing I would be interested in knowing is how how this interacts with, like, No Child Left Behind. Because I know teachers are, they're judged based on, you know, tests. Like, and you say that a lot of minority teachers are forced to only teach minority students. And how does that affect their careers if their test scores aren't as good, you know, because of their underprivileged backgrounds?
I think that's one of the biggest problems when you're looking at teacher evaluation, and these evaluation practices are usually determined at the local level. Mm-hmm. But students aren't put into classrooms at random. They're chosen, and that's determined by school administration. Mm-hmm. It would depend on the specific, evaluation system to see what impact that they had and what measures that they did to control for their students in that classroom.
Do you know if they have done those things in some school districts, if they controlled for that? If they'd said, I know you're a good teacher, so I'm going to send you to work with kids who have a harder time. And do they control for that when it comes around to evaluations? Or are they like, oh, your test scores weren't up to par, so sorry.
It depends. Sometimes I'll look at growth instead of just a specific benchmark.
Mm. Depends on if Betsy DeVos is being asked about this.
Isn't it sad that everybody in this room probably knows more than Betsy DeVos about education?
Growth versus proficiency? Tell me more.
But it is interesting. So
what's that?
I think moving forward, it will be interesting. So in 2015, ESSA was passed, or Every Student Succeeds Act was passed, and the guidelines that came out from the Department of Education during the Obama administration really tried to promote teacher diversity and mechanisms to support those teachers. So it'll be interesting to see if there's new guidance that is released when it comes to Title II and how that actually plays out.
So it seems like this is something that a lot of people acknowledge as a problem. Why do you think we haven't seen as much movement forward on this? Like, what are the obstacles that are currently in place that make these kind of policies that you've talked about difficult to implement? Do you think it's, like, a political issue? Do you think it's more, you know, it seems like a funding issue?
It's probably the same reason why nobody started caring about drug addiction until it started affecting white kids.
People. Yeah, that's my answer.
I mean, one of the, I guess the rebuttal on it is that there's just not enough black and brown people to really fill all of these roles. I mean, I went to predominantly Latino schools, and I was in advanced classes. I was in IB and gifted and talented in programs, and I don't remember having any teachers that were black or brown. And so if you're, and that's at a school where it's predominantly black and Latino, and yet there are no black or Latino teachers actually teaching the advanced placement classes. Mm. And there were teachers, but they just didn't teach the classes that I was in.
Right.
Yeah, I had a similar experience in high school where I was on advanced track and didn't have any black teachers at all, I don't believe. And then in college, I never had a black professor. And even for my African American studies, like writing class, I had a white teacher. So
that is,
I mean, not to say that white people can't teach about African American studies, because that would be false. And there's a lot of white people doing great research in that. But for it to be like the core, you know, you have like your core requirement classes. So it was one, because I was an African American studies major, that was just like a writing requirement I was fulfilling. So you would just think,
well, it doesn't send the best message. Like when you're an African American student and they're like, oh, look at everything that you can accomplish, and you don't see anybody that looks like you accomplishing those things.
But you can't find a black professor to
teach. Single one. And there was a black professor in the program who also taught the class. So there was two, but not in the time where I was trying to do my requirement, like not in that semester. Right. And I think she was like teaching in the summer. I think most people took her in the summer or something like that. So, and I went to school in the South, so it speaks to a little bit of the lack of understanding we have within our campus when a lot of like racial problems started happening, I think.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's another benefit too, is not just in the classroom, but also socially. Kind of, yeah, socially.
Yeah. I think there's also like a call for more diversity in other levels of education also, like such as school boards and maybe as principals or as just in the Department of Education, like though we there needs to be black and brown people in those roles as well. So I think just in general, there's a call for color in other levels of education.
I feel that this is something that you see in all aspects of education, is that people have identified a problem, but they're not willing to really do what needs to be done to actually try and tackle it. And a lot of times it's really hard and complicated, and not to make it sound super easy, but there are a lot of political reasons why more hasn't happened in terms of change in education.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much for this lively discussion, Mirel. We will be right back for our final segment, Spin This, so stay tuned. Hello and welcome back. We are now turning to our final segment that we call Spin This, where our hosts have a chance to speak off the cuff about policy and current events. So the way it works is that I spin a wheel app on my super fancy phone, and each of us will give our opinions about whatever topic the wheel stops on.
I don't think I've ever spoken on the cuff on anything in my entire life.
All right. So you will be speaking about the Comey memo and all of that, because it keeps evolving at a rate that I was not able to keep up with, and impeachment talks.
Okay, so where do I begin? Well, he should probably be impeached, honestly, based on everything we've heard so far. If it's true, that's it's an impeachable offense. Actually, I was listening to Trevor Noah, and he said that
this is our political expert Trevor Noah would say
this is the impeachable offense. Every time someone's been impeached, it's been for obstruction of justice. But you can't impeach him until you have an ironclad case, and right now we don't have an ironclad case, unfortunately. But now that we have this new special counsel, who's very well respected. I think that we're going to, this investigation will be as fair as it can be given the situation. I mean, it's impossible to appoint an independent prosecutor because the law just isn't there anymore. It was allowed to expire. I think that this is going to lead to impeachment. This is absolutely going to lead to impeachment.
Okay, who's next? I'll go next if no one else wants to go.
You go.
Am I supposed to go last? I don't know. All right, so I have Jeff Sessions' memo, Ray sentencing guidelines. Okay, so this is interesting. I feel like at a first read, it doesn't sound, you know, that scary. He's basically saying prosecutors should reach for the strict application of the most serious, readily provable offense. I think that the issue with this is that a lot of these kind of things are coming up in the context of the war on drugs, and I think in the context of our prison industrial complex, and having us always prosecute at the most serious offense, and a lot of times would be potentially like mandatory minimum sentences or, you know, 15 years for a relatively minor offense. And considering how much that mass incarceration costs us in terms of taxpayer money, in addition to just the moral cost of a systemically racist and classist system. So I think it's very unfortunate that our Attorney General has decided that we should be moving in a more punitive versus a less punitive direction. And I think that we were previously leading up to a moment where we could have had more bipartisan support for relaxing some of our harshest penalties. So this, to me, as someone who's really interested in criminal justice, is very disappointing.
That's a lot.
You get Betsy DeVos being booed at Bethune-Cookman University.
Yeah, so this is a great one. I think that this is reflective of the entire Trump campaign, and what what you do is a lot more important than what you say. And I think particularly in this case, especially when we're talking about making changes to student loans, cutting other education programs, which definitely positively impact Black communities, it makes perfect sense. I am also surprised that she was invited to speak in the first place, and I'm not sure if that was the best choice given your student body and understanding the struggles that your students go through. And when you're talking about cutting programs that your students benefit from, have benefited from, it just didn't seem like the best move.
I think it's shameful. And I think it's a sellout. And I think it shows, I think that they sold their soul by getting her as a speaker. And I think that it shows that HBCUs need money. Mm-hmm. But I think that it is disgraceful to get somebody from that administration to speak at her graduation.
So it's your turn, Liz. Okay. Let's see what you get. Okay. Actually, you know what? Since you're the last person, I feel like you should be able to choose from the remaining two topics. So, would you rather talk about...
I'll do transgender.
Okay.
Well, they're both.
So you're going to... Yeah, they're actually both. Yeah. So you're going to talk about the first federal transgender hate crimes conviction?
Yes.
Okay. Take it away.
Okay, so I think that I will praise, like you said, the irony of having to praise Sessions on this one, but
wait, are you praising the irony or are you praising Jim's
Sessions?
Push your luck.
Okay. Yeah, don't push your luck. But I think that it is great that I think it just speaks to things that need to happen not only for transgenders but for gays and for minorities. And I think that especially under this administration that hate crimes have been being brought to the forefront. So to see it actually punished, and then the sentence was 49 years. So, I mean, I think the most interesting thing to watch will be if he has to serve 49 years. But I think that it is a good step. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, because oftentimes people go to jail and get out in like 3 years. So I think it's a good step, and I think it speaks to problems that a lot of people face. It goes beyond transgender to speak to the needs and the rights and the protection that transgenders and anyone in the gay community, the transgender community, and even minorities kind of need that support. And I think it's a light of hope, but there's still a lot of progress to go with this administration. But that is a positive note to end on, I feel.
Awesome. Well, thank you to all of us for an excellent episode of WonkCast. We will see you next time.
This show is edited by Nathan Rupp, produced by Haley Dunn, and music by Pelly Gunther.
Starting to appreciate Nathan.
Would you shut up? You just ruined it again.